From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and whew, what a day. Republican Senator Jeff Flake, who earlier today announced he would vote for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh in the Senate Judiciary Committee, moments ago called for a week's delay in the floor vote in the full Senate so that a limited FBI investigation could look into accusations of sexual assault against the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh.
And I think that that we ought to do what we can to make sure that that we do all due diligence with a nomination this important. And I want to say that this committee has acted properly.
Well, the committee did immediately vote to send the nomination to full Senate, an 11-10 vote. But there's been a lot of confusion about what this all has meant.
And the developments come, of course, after a stunning moment on Capitol Hill this morning when live on TV, two angry, tearful women confronted Flake in a Senate elevator.
Look at me when I'm talking to you. You're telling me that my assault doesn't matter, that what happened to me doesn't matter, and that you're going to let people who do these things into power. That's what you're telling me when you vote for him.
Our politics contributors join us now. Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead political editor, and Nina Totenberg, NPR legal affairs correspondent. Nina, for people who are just tuning into this story, what has just happened? What's the headline?
The headline is that it appears that Jeff Flake has conditioned his vote for Kavanaugh or against Kavanaugh on whether or not there is a pause of 1 week for the FBI to investigate Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's allegations that Judge Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her some 36 years ago, and possibly other charges, for example, the ones brought by Ms. Ramirez, who made similar charges about him when he was at Yale. It is not at all clear what the limitations are on this FBI investigation, what they will be asked to go find out, how many corroborative witnesses they are going to talk to, if any. That all is to be worked out. And guess what? The FBI and its director, Christopher Wray, works for Donald Trump, and Donald Trump wants this nomination to go forward, and so does Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, who is probably right now bat bleep over this development.
Well, and we do have to point out, as Nina rightly notes there, this is up to the White House to call on an FBI investigation to actually open this up. This is not in the hands of Jeff Flake. This is not in the hands of Mitch McConnell. This is not in the hands of Chuck Grassley, the Senate Judiciary Committee chairman, who's all too happy to get this off his plate at this point. So it's up to the White House to go and call for an FBI investigation. We saw in that hearing yesterday that Dick Durbin, the Democrat from Illinois, had asked point blank of Brett Kavanaugh if he would be willing to turn around and ask Don McGahn, his good friend and who's a White House counsel, to tell the president to go and request that investigation, and he declined to do so.
But Domenico, isn't the difference now that you have Jeff Flake and his vote? And he has
kind
of indicated that he seems to have them over a barrel, or although maybe not. I mean, you can do the math for me, but he seemed to be saying, I will vote to send this to the full Senate, and I will vote in the full Senate if we have this investigation. By the way, we just saw Lindsey Graham talking, it appeared to be on Fox News, and he was so impassioned yesterday about how Kavanaugh had to be, you know, the Supreme Court justice. And we just saw him saying, I think what Jeff is saying kind of makes sense to me, this idea of an FBI investigation. So talk about that, Domenico. How much power does Flake have?
Well, Flake has a lot of power. If he decides to actually hold firm and not vote in favor of Brett Kavanaugh, he certainly could derail his nomination if he's not given the kind of investigation that he thinks is fit. Now, he's been in discussion with Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota and Senator Chris Coons from Delaware. They emerged from a back room off the Judiciary Committee hearing room, and that appears to be what swayed him. We saw Senator Klobuchar go to the cameras and speak as well. She appeared to be pretty pleased with this and said that he was at least one person who was willing to stand up. And she said they don't have the votes. They don't don't have the votes without him.
Well,
and the other thing, but the other thing that they have to really, that is not worked out, is the how much of an investigation this is. Is it just face saving or is it real?
We heard all day yesterday, Domenico. We heard all day yesterday from the senators, the Democrats. They were talking about the fact that there had to be an FBI investigation. In fact, Senator Durbin of Illinois pressed Judge Kavanaugh and said, do you want an FBI investigation to clear all this up? And he wouldn't answer that question. He kept saying, I'll do whatever the committee wants. Republicans have now spent the last 12 hours or so or more saying that an FBI investigation isn't going to clear anything up. But it sounds like now we're getting closer to having an FBI investigation.
We may be closer to an FBI investigation just because of the fact that in the last few minutes we heard Jeff Flake say that he wouldn't vote unless there was one, not in those strongly definitive terms. And, you know, there may be reason for Republicans to feel confident that at least a limited FBI investigation would actually help their cause. You saw Ted Cruz earlier today lay out in a very prosecutor-like way that none of the charges that Christine Blasey Ford puts forward have been corroborated because none of the witnesses at the party that she said were witnesses have come forward to definitively say that what happened happened. So, you know, this is something that maybe Lindsey Graham feels if they can somewhat limit the scope and they only investigate in a way where they only maybe talk to Dr. Ford again or they only talk to Brett Kavanaugh a little bit more and maybe try to touch base with some of these other folks and their stories don't change, then they would feel pretty confident that they could get him through.
Well, we should say Lindsey Graham is saying, I don't want this. He thinks that it's crazy and nothing's going to come from an investigation, but he feels that Jeff Flake, you know, is a good guy who wants to have some satisfaction, and that's fine. But, you know, I want to go back to what you were saying, Nina, about saving face. What do you, before that, just Domenico, one thought about what you just said about the people coming forward, because we always hear from listeners. We know that there were several people who were said to have been in that room with Blasey Ford, and she even acknowledged yesterday, well, they wouldn't have known what happened because it was upstairs and I ran out. And her friend, her girlfriend, since has said, I didn't see it, I don't know about it, but I believe her. And Mark Judge, who she says was in the room with Kavanaugh, people are calling for him to be subpoenaed. Your thoughts, Nina, on whether that might be a part of this equation? If there's an FBI investigation, does that then go to Mark Judge?
Well, it depends whether if he refuses to talk to the FBI, which is, you know, lying to the FBI is a federal crime. People don't usually get prosecuted for lying to Congress is the truth. There are some occasions, but lying to the FBI, they slap you upside the head for doing that.
Oh, yeah.
And so if they show up at your door and they want to talk to you and they're serious about it, they don't want to just take no for an answer. They say, look, we need to talk to you about where you were that summer. We need to talk to you about whether this behavior was the kind of thing that you ever saw. And, you know, there are a lot of people at Yale who have talked very freely to the press about having seen Kavanaugh indulge in drunken behavior and aggressive behavior when he was at Yale. And they've, you know, you can see them on cable TV. Well, are they willing to talk to the FBI? Because lying to the FBI is a federal crime. Are they willing? You know, how many of those people? I've had some people call me. At some point, as a reporter, you stop doing that work because you have to do your day job, so to speak. And but that's what the FBI does. And Dr. Ford has said if she could just know what time Mark Judge worked at that Potomac Safeway, it would help her narrow down the time when this happened because she remembered saying hello to him and him being very embarrassed after this event.
And a little bit of news here. President Trump has just weighed in on this, was asked about it, and he said whatever they think is necessary is okay in response to Flake's delay request. So we don't know what that means. We don't know if that means he'll request an FBI investigation or, as Nina has been saying, how fulsome that would be.
he said, I'm going to let the Senate handle that. They'll make their decisions. And he said he had
everyone
even,
pointing fingers
he,
back at each
he
other.
He also said he hadn't even thought even a little bit about alternatives if the Senate does not approve his nominee for the Supreme Court. Just about a minute left here. Nina, what comes next?
Some sort of an FBI investigation. How long, how complete it is remains to be seen, and how tough the Democrats are in negotiating at least an investigation that they can defend.
Okay, well, just to recap, we just watched the Senate Judiciary Committee vote along party lines, 11-10, to pass along the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the full Senate, with a request by Jeff Flake that there be at least a week of an FBI investigation.
And now we're hearing that there could be a vote this afternoon on whether to delay the Kavanaugh vote in the full Senate. So we will keep following all of that. Nina Totenberg, NPR legal affairs correspondent, and Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead political editor. Thank you so much to both of you.
You're welcome.
Sausage being made. Thousands of people in North Carolina are still in danger from that catastrophic flooding caused by Hurricane Florence, and several rivers are still cresting as that excess water makes its way through waterways. So what happens in the water's wake? The nonprofit Institute of Inspection, Cleaning, and Restoration Certification, or IICRC, has certified people on the ground in North Carolina to help with the cleanup. But there are things you should know before you start. Pete Duncanson is chair of the board for the IICRC. And Pete, what does that mean, you've certified people?
Well, we have technicians around the country, actually internationally, who have participated in our training courses and successfully passed the written exams associated with those courses. Beyond that, we have a group that we call our certified firms, which are a group of businesses that subscribe to a higher standard. Not only have they trained their employees and certified in the proper categories, but they have a customer complaint process, they have proper insurance and licensing, etc. And those are our elite businesses within the IICRC. Yeah.
And you want to, if you can, think about somebody who knows what they're doing, because we're talking about mold, which can destroy a house and also is unhealthy. We're talking about electrical issues. But as you well know, people want to get back and start doing stuff themselves. So what do you recommend? In our reading, it seems as if you're saying people should try to get back as fast as possible, walk if you have to, and there are traffic jams now in these areas in North and South Carolina. Walk if you can with a, you know, pulling some tools with you, because the water can be so destructive. Others, like the Belfour Property Restoration Company, are saying don't go back until officials tell you to go back. What do you think people should do?
Well, until the officials allow you back into an area, please do not re-enter that area. We have many areas with the river floods that are bringing in rising waters, sinkholes, and unfortunately pests. We do have to think about snakes and even the potential of alligators in that area. So it's safety is the primary concern.
Okay, you mentioned alligators, but what else is in this water? I mean, what's the toxins in there?
Well, it depends upon the area, and obviously because of the river floodings, we have the potential of sewage. There's a lot of pig farms in the area, so there's concern of that contamination, which is why we don't recommend people wade through standing water without protection.
Yeah, well, and you mentioned the lagoons that have the waste from the pig farms. There's, you know, 6,000 hogs who were killed by the flooding, so there's carcasses. I mean, it's tough going. But as your company has said, the longer the water sits and your building stays wet, the worse the damage. So get back there when it's safe. And do what? If you can't get one of these certified companies because they're going to be backed up, what can people start to do?
From a water standpoint, water cleanup or mold cleanup are really not a DIY project, unfortunately, because if you do it improperly, you can cause more damage. But you can control things by starting yourself. Using a detergent to clean things, and by that I mean you can go again to your big box store and buy a product called trisodium phosphate, TSP. A little bit of that in water acts as a basic detergent to clean surfaces, and then that is followed by an antimicrobial product, And in many cases, household bleach will work. Mixing bleach at a ratio of 1 to 5, one part bleach to 5 parts water, and then putting that on contaminated surfaces. Now be aware, if you're using products like this, you need to wear gloves. Bleach will do what it says. It bleaches, it discolors, it corrodes metals, etc. So you have to be very careful.
We should throw in face masks too. Oh, you wouldn't even want to go in a house without a face mask. Use a vacuum with a HEPA filter. That makes sense. I mean, again, if you're trying to at least get some of this done in the first 72 hours before you can get professionals in, how do you know when you can plug in a fan? How do you know when your electricity isn't going to short out because of water? Or how do you handle that?
Well, most homes don't short out after water intrusions. Mm-hmm. So if there's standing water, you're not going to turn the electricity on. You're going to pump the water out using generally gas-fired pumps and then start the dry down before you turn on the electricity.
What can happen if people, I mean, this gets expensive. There is insurance, but it never, you know, it's never enough. What can happen if people take shortcuts? For instance, painting over walls that were wet.
Molds are allergens, and you all of a sudden, you know, you start having colds or flu-like symptoms that you just can't get rid of, or sinus problems, asthmatic problems. Those are all indicators of an allergic reaction caused from microbial growth, such as mold or bacteria. That's generally the result of things being done in a shortcut method or not dried properly.
How long does it take mold to really take over a house? And, you know, how bad have you seen it after one of these floods?
How bad have I seen it? I've seen homes that are 3 stories, floor to ceiling, covered in mold because they were left untouched. Generally, we see within 48 to 72 hours is when mold growth really starts to amplify if it's not treated.
Yeah. Pete Duncanson, chair of the board for the nonprofit Institute of Inspection, Cleaning, and Restoration Certification, or IICRC. They certify companies to clean up and have advice. We'll link you to some at herenow.org. Pete, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your time and what you do for the industry.
Okay, well, we wish them all well there in the Carolinas. But now to a question. Does it matter if teachers and their students are the same race? How important is it for minority students in particular to even see teachers who look like them? Well, a new report from the Institute of Labor Economics suggests it's very important. Nick Papageorge is the study's co-author. The study is called The Long-Run Impacts of Same-Race Teachers. He's also an assistant professor in the economics department at Johns Hopkins University. Nick, give us a little bit more of the headline from your story.
I think the kind of big headline finding is that students who are assigned randomly, or as good as randomly, depending on which state we're looking at, to a teacher who is of the same race, so we're looking at black students with black teachers, are far less likely to drop out of high school. So we find numbers, for example, like if a black student is assigned to a black teacher in the 3rd to 5th grade in North Carolina, their chances of dropping out of high school drop by about a third. I mean, the results that we have, for example, looking at black students with black teachers, you know, we find actually stronger effects for black male students when they're faced with a black teacher of any gender.
Well, there was no different effect on white children when they had a black teacher.
That's correct.
But the profound effect on black children, far more likely to, boys especially, far more likely not to drop out, far more likely boys and girls to go to college. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you think some of the reasons are here? People are talking about, you know, just being able to see someone who looks like you and that inspiration, you know, that if they can do it, I can do it. But also people are talking about implicit bias, that a black male teacher teaching a black boy may not have a bias that another teacher may not even know they have, a white teacher, that they don't have an expectation for that young black boy.
That's right. And actually, the work that my team and I have been doing, I think, speaks exactly to that. We find that black teachers tend to have higher expectations for black students than do white teachers. And we also find that one of the ways that this seems to have an effect on students' outcomes is through students' own perspectives. We find that if you have a black teacher who has high expectations, then your own expectations shift upwards. And that can be a mechanism through which these kinds of role model effects are working.
And we've talked about other research. Preschool teachers judge black children more harshly for the same behavior that white children have. They assess black students differently from white students, are less likely, white teachers are less likely than black teachers to put black students in gifted and talented programs, even if their test scores are exactly the same. But we're understanding, too, from this reporting on your study that some schools seizing this material are realizing that just telling white teachers that you have this bias sometimes helps change it.
Yeah, I think that that's a really, really crucially important point. When I think about my own experiences, what keeps me up at night is maybe I had the wrong expectations for my students, but not because I had some sort of negative animus towards them, but more like maybe my expectations were a little bit too low, not because I thought the kid wasn't smart enough, but maybe I was just too worried about all the difficult things that they were facing at home and how that would affect their educational trajectories. And maybe somebody needed to come in and sort of tell me that so I could check my own bias. I think that when we start to think about it in this way, this becomes, in some sense, a little bit more positive because we're not dealing with, raging racists or something like that. But it's also a little bit scary to me because it means that there's this kind of well-intentioned bias that can be going on, which is very insidious because you're not talking about people who are hateful. You're talking about people with good intentions.
Well, it's just fascinating. We'll post your reporting at hereandnow.org, along with a story that we did on a national movement to try to get more black men into the teaching world because of research like yours. That's Nick Papageorge. The study is The Long-Run Impacts of Same-Race Teachers. He's an assistant professor in the economics department at Johns Hopkins University. Nick, professor, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We are following the breaking news this afternoon from Washington. Republican Senator Jeff Flake calling for a delay in the vote on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh in the full Senate, pending an FBI investigation into the allegations against Kavanaugh. Millions of women across the country watched yesterday as Christine Blasey Ford testified that she was sexually assaulted by Kavanaugh. Michaela LaFrac from member station WAMU spoke with students at an all-women's school in Washington as they watched Dr. Ford's testimony.
At Trinity Washington University, 3 miles from the Capitol, about 24 young women sat in a dark classroom. On a big projection screen, Christine Blasey Ford was in a blue suit facing the Senate Judiciary Committee. The student's sociology professor, Sister Mary Johnson, gave them a brief introduction.
So this is the chair, Senator Chuck Grassley.
Trinity Washington is an all-women Catholic university. Around 90% of the students are Black or Latina, and most are low-income. Over the next hour, the women were rapt. No one spoke, and they rarely looked at their phones. All eyes were on Ford.
This is how I met Brett Kavanaugh, the boy who sexually assaulted me. During my freshman and sophomore
After about an hour of watching, students from various classrooms gathered in another room to debrief. Not everyone was on the same page. Here's one student, Naya Younger from D.C.
Like, I understand, like, yes, she was traumatized as a teenager, but, I mean, it shouldn't have took her that long to speak up.
Others disagreed, like Fatima Fofama. She's from Sierra Leone, but went to high school in Maryland. And she said she didn't understand why people were questioning Ford's credibility, but not Kavanaugh's.
Is it because of his, like, social status? Is it because he's a male? What is it? So if she's over there missing out of work, then he should be placed in the same situation.
Both Kavanaugh and Ford grew up in the D.C. area and went to elite prep schools. About half of the Trinity Washington students I spoke to were also D.C. area natives, but none went to prep school. Still, they all said they've had experiences like the one Ford described, or knew people who did.
I had my fists were clenched, like, under my desk. I was seriously, like, trying not to, like, just get up and yell. That's how much pain I was in.
That's Vanessa Perry, a student from California, describing what it was like to watch Ford testify.
It was reminiscent of when my friends told me about when they were assaulted, when I got calls at night, like, hey, I have to talk to you. Something happened, and I need to tell you.
Next to her, Chanel Mullins nodded and anxiously tapped her headphone earbuds on the table. She's from Jamaica and says she hears about sexual assaults all the time.
It feels like it was someone that was so close to me, like I know her, because I've listened to other story before.
Is this something that people in your circles, in your family or friends have experienced?
Yeah. This stuff still happening.
At the end of the conversation, the students tried to sum up their feelings and responses in a word or phrase.
Determined.
Frustration.
Powerful and strong.
Very painful.
Different.
That last voice was Naya Younger, the student who said she didn't quite believe Ford at the beginning.
When I was watching it, I was like, well, she could have just said something. But now I'm more sensitive to the situation. It opened my eyes to certain things.
For Here and Now, I'm Michaela Lafrak.
We want to take a few minutes now to listen to some of the extraordinary moments that have happened in Washington in the last day or so. Just in the last hour, Jeff Flake, the Republican senator, voted to advance Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's nomination out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, but he said he wanted to delay the full Senate vote pending an FBI investigation into the allegations against Kavanaugh. And just in the last few minutes, Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says she supports that delay. This comes after yesterday's bombshell testimony on Capitol Hill. This is Christine Blasey Ford speaking to senators about what she says Brett Kavanaugh did to her more than 30 years ago.
I was pushed onto the bed, and Brett got on top of me. He began running his hands over my body and grinding into me. I yelled, hoping that someone downstairs might hear me, and I tried to get away from him, but his weight was heavy. Brett groped me and tried to take off my clothes. He had a hard time because he was very inebriated and because I was wearing a one-piece bathing suit underneath my clothing. I believed he was going to rape me. I tried to yell for help. When I did, Brett put his hand over my mouth to stop me from yelling. This is what terrified me the most and has had the most lasting impact on my life. It was hard for me to breathe, and I thought that Brett was accidentally going to kill me. Both Brett and Mark were drunkenly laughing during the attack. They seemed to be having a very good time. Mark seemed ambivalent, at times urging Brett on, and at times telling him to stop. A couple of times I made eye contact with Mark and thought he might try to help me, but he did not. During this assault, Mark came over and jumped on the bed twice while Brett was on top of me. And the last time that he did this, we toppled over and Brett was no longer on top of me. I was able to get up and run out of the room. Directly across from the bedroom was a small bathroom. I ran inside the bathroom and locked the door. I waited until I heard Brett and Mark leave the bedroom, laughing, and loudly walk down the narrow stairway, pinballing off the walls on the way down. I waited, and when I did not hear them come back up the stairs, I left the bathroom, went down the same stairwell, through the living room, and left the house. I remember being on the street and feeling an enormous sense of relief that I had escaped that house, and that Brett and Mark were not coming outside after me. Brett's assault on me drastically altered my life. For a very long time, I was too afraid and ashamed to tell anyone these details.
Christine Blasey Ford speaking yesterday. Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court nominee, offered a fiery defense. He completely denied the allegations, and he said that before them, it looked like he was going to be confirmed.
When I did at least okay enough at the hearings that it looked like I might actually get confirmed, a new tactic was needed. Some of you were lying in wait and had it ready. This first allegation was held in secret for weeks by a Democratic member of this committee and by staff. It would be needed only if you couldn't take me out on the merits. When it was needed, this allegation was unleashed and publicly deployed over Dr. Ford's wishes. And then, as no doubt was expected, if not planned, came a long series of false last-minute smears designed to scare me and drive me out of the process before any hearing occurred. Crazy stuff. Gangs, illegitimate children, fights on boats in Rhode Island. All nonsense reported breathlessly and often uncritically by the media. This has destroyed my family and my good name, a good name built up through decades of very hard work and public service at the highest levels of the American government. This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups. This is a circus. The consequences will extend long past my nomination. The consequences will be with us for decades. This grotesque and coordinated character assassination will dissuade competent and good people of all political persuasions from serving our country. And as we all know, in the United States political system of the early 2000s, what goes around comes around.
Kavanaugh and Blasey Ford took questions from Democratic senators, and Republican senators asked that their questions be posed by an outside prosecutor from Arizona, Rachel Mitchell, a sex crimes prosecutor from Maricopa County, until Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, the Republican senator there, decided he wanted to talk himself and ask questions himself. Here he is standing up for Brett Kavanaugh.
If you wanted an FBI investigation, you could have come to us. What you want to do is destroy this guy's life, hold this seat open, and hope you win in 2020. You've said that, not me. You've got nothing to apologize for. When you see Sotomayor and Kagan, tell them that Lindsey said hello, because I voted for them. I would never do to them what you've done to this guy. This is the most unethical sham since I've been in politics. And if you really wanted to know the truth, you sure as hell wouldn't have done what you've done to this guy. Are you a gang rapist?
No.
I cannot imagine what you and your family have gone through. Boy, y'all want power. God, I hope you never get it. I hope the American people can see through this sham, that you knew about it and you held it. You had no intention of protecting Dr. Ford. None. She's as much of a victim as you are. God, I hate to say it, because these have been my friends. But let me tell you, when it comes to this, you're looking for a fair process. You came to the wrong town at the wrong time, my friend. Do you consider this a job interview?
The advice and consent role is like a job
interview. You consider that you've been through a job interview.
I've been through a process of advice and consent under the Constitution. Which
would you say you've been through hell?
I've been through hell and then some.
This is not a job.
So that was one exchange from yesterday. Here's Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, asking Kavanaugh whether there should be an FBI investigation into the allegations.
Judge Kavanaugh, earlier today, Dr. Christine Ford sat in that same chair. And under oath, she said clearly and unequivocally that she was a victim of sexual assault at your hands. She answered our questions directly, and she didn't flinch at the prospect of submitting herself to an FBI investigation of these charges. We know, and I'm sure she's been advised by our attorneys, that a person lying to the FBI can face criminal prosecution. You have clearly and unequivocally denied that you assaulted Dr. Ford. With that statement, you must believe that there is no credible evidence or any credible witness that could prove otherwise. You started off with an impassioned statement at the beginning, and I can imagine, try to imagine what you have been through or your family's been through, and I'm sure I wouldn't get close to it. But it was an impassioned...
No, you wouldn't.
I'm sure I wouldn't. It's an impassioned statement. And in the course of it, you said, I welcome any kind of investigation. I quote you. I welcome any kind of investigation. I've got a suggestion for you. Right now, turn to your left in the front row to Don McGahn, counsel to President Donald Trump. Ask him to suspend this hearing and nomination process until the FBI completes its investigation of the charges made by Dr. Ford and others.
And goes so that was the suggestion yesterday. Today, the news is that Jeff Flake, Republican from Arizona, has called for a delay in the Kavanaugh vote in the full Senate pending an FBI investigation.
New data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show the number of children born with syphilis in the U.S. is higher than it's been in 20 years. The number of cases of congenital or from birth syphilis more than doubled between 2013 and 2017. And the state with the highest reported incidence of the disease is Louisiana. Dr. Rebecca Gee is the secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health. She joins us now. And Dr. Remind us why we were so worried about this. What is syphilis? What does it do?
So, of course, syphilis is a disease that causes neurodegenerative conditions and was described as a disease that caused madness. Of course, what we're dealing with in Louisiana is congenital syphilis, or babies who are born with this condition at no fault of their own and live with lifelong sequelae. And so this is should have been a disease of the past, and it's only as a result of broken systems of care and disinvestments in public health over a generation that have led to a resurgence, and it's something we're taking very seriously.
Let's talk more about that. When you say sequelae, it's a word we've been hearing. That means consequences. We have consequences of this. So what is happening, first of all, for these babies?
So babies born to moms with syphilis can have poor pregnancy outcomes. They can have death. They can have symptoms that result in deformities, delays in development or seizures, problems like rash, enlarged livers and spleens, jaundice, which makes babies turn yellow. They can have syphilitic rhinitis or snuffles that can be highly contagious. Yeah. Of course, longer down the road, they can get damage to their bones, teeth, eyes, ears, and brain. So this is a serious problem.
So why? Tell us more about why you think it's happening, this lack of attention. What's going on?
So when Governor Edwards and I started in 2016 in Louisiana, one in four people in Louisiana did not have access to health care, only through an emergency room or through a charity system that had long wait lists. With our Medicaid expansion, we've changed that, and 480,000 people now have access to care. But the result of generations of people not having access to care means that they had infectious diseases and conditions that went unrecognized. Syphilis is really a result of a lack of investment in public health systems, a lack of ability of people to get access to care. And, in a country like ours, it shouldn't be happening.
Well, I mean, what kind of care? Are you talking about preventive care? Because we should add, it's not just syphilis. The CDC reported last month that the total number of cases of syphilis, but also gonorrhea and chlamydia, these are all sexually transmitted, reached a record high in 2017. So is it information?
I think it's a variety of things. Of course, Louisiana is one of the poorest states in the nation. 40% of our residents live below 200% of poverty. And poverty, lack of education, lead to risky behaviors. And, of course, that plays into high syphilis rates, but also when people don't have access to primary care. I called CVS this morning to see what it would be like for a patient to get a syphilis medication treatment for their syphilis, and they told me it would cost between $400 and $3,000, depending on whether I had insurance or not, and that they don't stock it and they have to order it. So you think about, even if you are able to get a diagnosis with syphilis, so you have access to primary care, or you've been in an emergency room and had a syphilis test. It's very hard to get access to this medication because the pharmaceutical industry has raised the price. Mm. And so there are a variety of reasons why it's hard to get treatment. But it's also important that people get access to primary care. And it's also important that women who often are in prenatal care are getting reinfected by their partners. So some of this is classic public health, and our public health professionals are the silent soldiers of these diseases. And when over years you've disinvested in them and you've disinvested in public health clinics, it means that the safety net for things like HIV, infectious diseases, even vaccines in hard-to-reach areas, it has eroded.
Okay, quick lightning round. Can you cure syphilis with these treatments? Can you prevent it by, say, wearing a condom? And is there anything a mother can do who has syphilis, you know, obviously if she's going to have a vaginal birth, to keep from passing it on to her child? And is that how it's passed on to the child?
Yeah, it's transmitted mother to child. It is very curable through penicillin G or penicillin. It just requires that women get treated. Some women need multiple treatments, and some because they may get reinfected, or one treatment isn't effective. And so the treatments work, but they require stable access to care. They require identification of the partner and treatment of the partner. And of course, we can prevent transmission. But what we're finding in Louisiana is a lot of women are getting infected during pregnancy. They may have had a syphilis test, but they didn't get a repeat test. And our legislature passed in 2014 a law that requires opt-out testing, but still some women are falling through the cracks.
Dr. Rebecca Gee, Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And then, by the way, she tells us that condoms do help. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.